hikes.
We all love to go out and enjoy the great outdoors. We see these beautiful trails. Sometimes we hike through the woods. In fact, this past weekend, I was on a trail where we saw some trees that had just freshly been cut and moved off to the side. And we also got to take in some incredible projects that have probably been done over the last 50, 60, 70 years. Volunteers do a lot of this work, but a great deal of it needs to be funded. Where does the money come from? Some organizations put money into this. Is it our tax dollars? Well, my tax dollars, our tax dollars, probably don't even tell half the story of where the funding comes from for these conservation and recreation projects. To help us with that, the answer to where this money comes from and how we can be looking at this down the road is a gentleman who has a career in conservation spanning two decades. He's currently the president and CEO of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, a North American membership conservation organization based in Missoula, Montana. They're dedicated to being a voice to protecting wild public lands and the people who use them, becoming an advocate for these resources. Land, Tawny, welcome to Papa Bear Hikes.
Martin, thanks for having me, man.
So, Land, I first learned about you, found out about you, reading an article, an August 19th, 2021 article written by Christine Peterson, and it was talking about funding land conservation. And what, I don't know, maybe we can kind of see as a little bit of a controversy or sticky subject that's starting to rear its head now. And that is, how do we fund these projects? And we know traditionally over 50% of this money has come from two acts, the Pittman-Robertson Act and the Dingell-Johnson Act. Can we talk about a little bit about the history of how the funding for these conservation and recreation projects have, the origin of them and how they've evolved over the years?
Sure. So I think I'd start with kind of where it all came from. And really, back in the 1930s, I think people are well aware of the Dust Bowl and the effects that was having on wildlife in particular, the effects that was having on people. And so we were in pretty big trouble in this country. And, one of the things that came out of that, I would say there's, two major things. The first one I would call out would be the duck stamp. So the duck stamp, federal duck stamp that you have to purchase as a waterfowl hunter every single year. Right now it's at $25, which I think is actually a pretty darn good deal. But you have to purchase that every single year. And then that money goes directly to the National Wildlife Refuge System to help them manage, but also purchase new wetlands, for waterfowl. I think that there's been a ton of money put into that over the years. I think it's at the tune, and I don't have that right in front of me, I think it's $600 million. I think they've been able to purchase 6 million acres of new public lands, for national wildlife refuges, for ducks and for all the other birds that and other species that are obligate to those kind of wetland areas. So that's the first piece. And I think that, I would say that hunters asked to be, that we wanted to pay that, and we still do today. And it's something that I think that we're very proud of. The second piece would be something that you alluded to. So so the Pittman-Robertson Act originally started on ammunition and gun sales, and at the tune of about 10 to 11%. And that 10 to 11%, again, was asked for by us as hunters, asked for by the gun manufacturers at that point. Like, we want to pay this excise tax. And so this can go in to fund our state agencies in particular and all the good work that they do. So later on, we added fishing equipment. That's with and in addition, added archery equipment as well. And so about $1 billion is generated a year from that. Now that's split up between 50 states. They can use that, for wildlife management. They can use that for hunter education. They can use that for some gun ranges. But $1 billion a year that hunters are paying into that system. And it's something that, I think that all of us as hunters and anglers are very proud of and we're excited about. I think, when it comes to just the management of public lands, that budget is overall budget in our national budget here in the United States that gets put forward every year. Is that has dwindled to less than 1%. It used to be around 2% of the overall budget. And so that less than 1%, that means that, our public land agencies like the U.S. Forest Service, That means the Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park System. They have less money to manage now than they did, decades ago. And so I would say that there's probably more impacts happening on our public lands from use right now. And so that juxtaposition of switching that around isn't great. But overall, you know, every American pays in around $2 from their taxes to pay for the management of our public lands. But ultimately, hunters and anglers are, you know, through Pittman-Robertson, through the Duck Stamp, through organizations like the Elk Foundation, Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, that are doing a lot of projects on the ground, Trout Unlimited, they're paying the lion's share of, as you said, the projects that are on the ground.
Yeah, land, it's very impressive. I don't hunt. I haven't really fished much in over the last 30 years, but beyond taking my kids out when they were younger here and there, I'm more of a backpacker, hiker, you know, canoeing, biker, et cetera.
Sure.
But I just think it's so impressive that, you know, back then the mindset was, well, we're enjoying this. We want to preserve it. So we're going to put up money to preserve it. But we've seen the trends shifting in the use of these lands. Like as a hiker, you know, there's times during the year where, you know, there's lands we don't go into because they're hunting areas and they're very short periods. But there's projects going in those areas that the people that we're sharing it with are paying for, with the ammunition and guns, or if it's fishing, their fishing equipment. But the trends have been, and I've seen this myself. I grew up, my father worked in a sporting goods store, and in the late 60s, that store was primarily focused on hunting and fishing equipment. And by the 70s, there was a switch. It was starting to become more backpacking. Some of the things were more traditionally relating to the outdoors. And it seems there's been a trend where there's less people hunting, fishing, than there are people hiking, canoeing, rock climbing, biking, right? That list is like grown tenfold since this act was passed. In fact, I did a little research. Did you know that the year the act was passed, that was the year the Appalachian Trail was completed? So hiking, backpacking wasn't even on the map at that point, literally, yeah. Right? So trends have changed. And it seems to me that it's time, possibly at times even past, we're even past that time where we need to be looking for a more equitable way to fund these projects.
You know, and I think equitable maybe is one way to say it. I think that, you know, what I start with probably is, you know, the funding needs, which is that equitable piece that you're talking about. So this last year, you know, during COVID, or I guess a year plus now, is that, you know, people have really been gravitating to the outdoors, you know, either for their first time or reconnecting. And they're doing that to find solace. They're doing that in a lot of ways. I mean, boat sales, bike sales, anything really with wheels is been selling, or kayaks, you know, anything that is used in the outdoors has done really well during COVID in a lot of ways because of the increased demand. And, you know, people have all sorts of different reasons. You know, maybe they're not taking that trip down to Mexico, or maybe they're not taking that trip down, you know, to the beach. They're doing stuff more locally. And so, you know, I think that influx of new people, you know, hunting and fishing numbers have gone up this last year, because people are getting out. And so what that does is that provides more impacts. And, you know, how do we pay for those impacts? And, you know, a couple summers ago, we got passed the Great American Outdoors Act. And one of the provisions in there was to pay for a backlog of maintenance on our public lands and public waters all around the country. That's to a tune of $20 billion is the need. That bill that was passed by overwhelmingly bipartisan fashion was about $9.5 billion. So we got about half of what we need to take care of the backlog. So there's that huge need that's there. So yes, I think whether it's that or habitat projects or trail projects, there's some big need out there. And maybe some of that is even, you know, new trails or new facilities. And so the need is there. And I think, you know, that I would love for folks to take some ownership and think about how they can pay into that system. The other piece, though, like that's even more important, I think, for me is that, you know, hunters and anglers, again, wear this like with this, these excise taxes with pride. I mean, we're paying, you know, on a $100 item, we're paying, you know, $110. On a $500 item, you know, we're paying $150. Or $550. And to me, like we're proud of that, right? Like we're glad that is going down. And so I think that part of this, of kind of spreading this out and amongst other users, it's important to know that, like, I think that that connection to the outdoors and being proud of and having some ownership of how our public lands are managed and what is going on, I think is vitally important. And, you know, I think that, you know, we can start to get into maybe some specifics, but, you know, I spent some time in the boundary waters of northern Minnesota in a canoe this summer with my kids. You know, I hike with my kids. You know, I have a raft that, you know, I use for fishing a lot, but I also take a lot of leisure cruises. And so hunters and anglers, you know, mountain bike, they kayak, they do all the things a lot of the times. And so while this would be an additional kind of contribution by hunters and anglers, I think it would also open the door for a bunch more user groups to participate. So that contributes money, but it also makes them feel like they're part of a system.
And because if you look at the big picture here, and you probably don't, I don't think you have to even go back to 1937, maybe just over the last 30 years, you know, there's a larger proportion, proportionally hunters and anglers are making up a smaller amount of the people that are having an impact on this. So just go to any of these trailheads in the popular areas. I mean, we're heading up on Labor Day weekend. And by the time this airs, I think it'll be after Labor Day, but you know, picture this, go to any of these popular areas and those parking lots are going to be filled with people hiking. Okay. Yeah, but how much money? Again, well, I'm paying taxes, but you know what? The people that are paying the lion's share of this are the hunters and anglers. Now they've termed it, and I don't know where this came from. You know, the common vernacular seems to be backpack tax, right?
Sure.
And when I read the article, one of the things that popped in my head was this whole "not in my backyard" syndrome. Right? I love this. I'm enjoying it, but don't ask me to pay any more money for it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, so the backpack tax, I mean, like that came out of 2000 and this thing called the Care and Reinvestment Act that, you know, was going to propose some excise taxes similar to what we have on guns and ammunition, fishing gear and archery equipment. That did not pass back in 2000, but that's where that term, I think, originally, you know, came out. I would say I'd rather us call it like an outdoor legacy fund and that outdoor legacy fund because it's paying it forward. And, you know, I don't think that anybody is talking about the 10 to 11% that we pay on hunting and fishing equipment. We're talking about, you know, let's say 1%. So on, you know, $100 backpack, that's $101. On a $1,000 backpack, right? Like that's like a $1,010. And so to me, there's opportunity for us to think about how people contribute. I think that, you know, a lot of the companies that are out there, the most boisterous, you know, talk about excise taxes, which I totally understand. They're paying excise taxes, you know, from overseas already. And, you know, let's think about those either, you know, reapportioning those or, you know, pass that on to the consumer. Again, I'm willing to pay $505 or $101, you know, $1,010. I'm willing to pay an extra 1%. Myself, and I think a majority of people were, knowing that it would go back to the lands and waters that they care so much about and that they recreate in. I think that's, you know, the users, like at least from the hunting side, like we're used to it and we are prideful about it. And I think that other user groups will be the same way.
And I think a lot of us could learn from the, like you said, the hunters and anglers are proud of this. You know, we're contributing with our pockets. You know, we're not just being responsible in our activities, but we're putting money into this. I got to tell you, I mean, and, you know, I know people are probably going to not like to hear what I'm saying because taxes have become such a dirty word now, but going back to 1937, right, where they said, you know, this, we need to do this, you know, for ourselves, if for anything else, but I would gladly pay what you were saying, like 1% more for my hiking and backpacking gear, knowing that it was going to preserve and the land I was hiking or have more projects in that area. Myself personally, yeah, I look at that and I say, yeah, I'm okay with that. And when you think about this, and shame on me, I should have done a little research, but like the average through hiker of one of these long distance trails, any one of the big three, we'll say Continental Divide, Pacific Crest, Appalachian, they're probably spending about $1,500 on their gear for their through hike, plus the other things that the other costs as they go along on their trip. You know, that could have an impact, a substantial impact, I would think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, again, out of that, and my math, you have to check my math, but like out of that $1,500, we're talking like, you know, $15 that would go back to conservation. And then you think about all in conservation and recreation, I would say. And you think about all the people that are doing through hikes, you know, that money starts to add up pretty quickly. And, you know, helps us, you know, I use this analogy, Martin. So, you know, let's think about our public lands as our house or our car. When you own a house or a car, you're constantly doing maintenance on that house or car so you don't have, you know, some big ticket item that comes through. And so that you don't, you know, you can get the best use out of either your car or your house. If you don't do that, you got to replace a roof or you got to, you know, like gotta do some things structurally to your house, or maybe that's replacing an engine in your car because you did not do the care and maintenance. So a lot of this is talking about how do we figure out to do the care and maintenance of our public lands and our public waters. And so that we don't have to, you know, be faced with the $20 billion backlog that we are right now, that we're just taking care of in a piece. Like, it's going to be awesome once we finally take care of that backlog. There's also going to be all these other impacts that happen at the same time. And so how do we make sure that that's more of a steady kind of maintenance versus an emergency piece?
Yeah. And, you know, interesting you use the house analogy because, right, you let the repairs go on your house, right? How quick they start to add up. You go from needing a new roof, new windows, right? And then it's like, okay, once I get caught up on these things I need to do to make my house safe and structurally sound, then I can remodel the kitchen and paint the outside and do the things to make it even better.
Totally. Yeah. We just want to take, I mean, I think a lot of this is about just doing, just taking care of the infrastructure, let alone, you know, trying to enhance it.
Yeah. Cause I've come across, you know, again, the majority of my experiences as a backpacker, you know, and there's shelters that are really in bad shape and mm-hmm. the volunteers do a great job of upkeep. They do what they can. But it always comes down to the money. Where's the money coming from to replace? And it's not cheap to replace one of these shelters. It can go anywhere, cost anywhere, I believe, from like $9,000 to maybe $20,000. Some of that's influenced by transportation logistics to get the materials to the location. Even, you know, despite the fact that most of the work is done by volunteers, there's still a big expense just in buying materials and getting them to the location. And that's not going away. And with the finite amount of resources available, I just don't see the volunteers being able to keep up with this.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, hats off to those volunteers, hats off to those organizations that are helping raise money, you know, to supplement those structures. I would say that, you know, this to me, and we haven't talked about this piece yet, but the, you know, outdoor economy in this country generates $887 billion a year. That is a sustainable source, you know, of funding for a lot of small communities in this country, but also, you know, that's in every single town in America. And so to me, you know, let's double down on, you know, and invest in the infrastructure that provides that $887 billion. And so not only is it sustainable, but it is something that we can grow. And, you know, again, with all these new folks that are, you know, experiencing the outdoors for the first time or reconnecting, let's make sure they have a great time while they're there. And so they continue to, you know, take part. And once you're out, you know, in the woods and on the water, you know, you have that connection and you're much more apt to try to, you know, protect and conserve those places if you're out experiencing them. So let's make sure that we're doing that. And at the same time, you know, provide a super stable, I would say, contribution to our economy that, you know, goes from a very local, small community, you know, to a national level.
And I've had people on talk to about this, and yeah, it's that ripple effect it has in these local economies. That's what comes to mind first, right? You go to an area and you hunt, your fish, whatever your activity is that you choose to do, and you're going to probably stop, gas up your car, maybe grab a bite to eat. It's going to have a rippling effect through these economies, right on up from local, state to the federal economies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, I know that, you know, I'm here in Montana and there's a lot of small towns and communities that look at our hunting season as, you know, a long Christmas season because, you know, they're small communities and places that don't get visited very often except during hunting season. And so while that influx of people comes in, it is a boost to the economy while they're there.
Yeah, out here in the Northeast, noticing that we have a lot of ski areas here, in addition to hunting and fishing, but my thoughts right now are with these ski areas, these communities that are dependent on the winter for their economies. And they're making the adjustments to try to appeal to the other outdoor activities like hiking and fishing and mountain biking and things like that. You know, to try to expand, to go from being a one season to a 3 or 4 season economy.
Well, you know, and Martin, I think that one of the ways we do that is help with infrastructure, right? And so, you know, I'm not going to, you know, I don't have all the answers on how this money should be set up, how it should be distributed. But like, let's say that, you know, there's a 1%, you know, excise tax or, you know, outdoor legacy fund that we should probably try to keep calling it. But let's say that that's on skis. And that contribution then, like, could that be used to enhance those ski areas? And so not only are they being used in the winter, but they're also being used in the, you know, the summer season, even the shoulder seasons, you know, through mountain bikers or hiking. Or, I mean, I know our local spot here in Missoula, Snowbowl, has like some fall fame during the summer, frisbee golf. And so I think there's ways, you know, to think about how we utilize that money to spur kind of economic development and infrastructure development that can help, you know, us maximize the opportunities we have around this outdoor economy.
Right. This could, I think maybe in addition to changing it from backpack tax to outdoor legacy fund, which I really like that term a lot, right? Because that kind of covers it all right there, an outdoor legacy fund. But looking at that as a bigger, big picture situation, looking at the bigger picture here, right? That it's not going to just maybe put in a new parking lot at a trailhead, but that new parking lot is going to generate people going to the businesses that are located near that parking lot, or that people need to, the little towns that the people drive through to get there.
You know, I was just in upstate New York, and we were in Westkill, New York. Mm-hmm. So Westkill is a small little community. It's outside of Woodstock. It's in the, and it's this awesome spot. Like, I mean, there's a lot of state public lands around there because of the, they were protected to protect the watershed for New York City. It's this amazing spot. And there's this brewery there, the Westkill Brewery, that is out, you know, at the end of this road.
Oh, I've been there.
You have. So it's amazing, right?
Yes, it is.
It's great beer. It's an awesome location. And, you know, we had an event there over a weekend. And it was awesome for me to see is, you know, obviously we brought a lot of people in there from, you know, the Northeast, I would say, just our chapter leaders and our members. But the thing that was so awesome to see was all the bikers and all the hikers that were going to the brewery after they'd been on those state lands. And that brewery, you know, is really connected, I would say, to that landscape because those people are coming there to recreate. And so that provides this, that brewery would not, I would say, be functional without that recreational kind of opportunities that are around. And so it's, you know, you shall build it, they will come.
Yeah, you know, I do a lot of my hiking in the Catskills. I live in upstate New York, okay. Further west. I live outside the Binghamton area. And I remember when they opened and my friends and I, we stopped there and we're like, you know, this is kind of a cool concept, but there's nothing else around here. It's a little far from Hunter Ski Resort. And, you know, so other than hikers during the hiking season and maybe hunters and fishermen, you know, they got not a big pool here to draw from, but you go there now and the place is packed.
It's packed. I mean, like, you know, and they're having music and I mean, it's so impressive to see. And I think that, you know, that can happen, you know, all over this country in small communities in particular that, you know, have this base of the outdoor economy.
Right. I mean, that's become a destination now for people that drive out to that area that, you know, it is a nice place to stop, have a cold beer and get some food because they have the vending trucks there and, it's a great experience. And you're right. That's just an example of how people that enjoy the outdoors, the impact we can have on an economy. They started out, it looked like they started out of a barn. The first time I went there, you literally stood outside and you had like a little counter and you paid and got your glass of beer and sat down outside to now they have indoor seating and a patio area. And, it's been 3 years now since they opened.
But, yeah, that's turned into you know, like a promo for Westkill Brewing. But I will tell you that Mike and his crew are top notch people. So I'm glad that became part of this.
Right. Yeah, I know we're kind of getting off topic now, but yeah, that kind of I found that interesting and exciting that you had been there. But also, you know, to make it part of this conversation here, to get back on topic, it is a great example of the impact we can have on local economies.
Absolutely, absolutely, and you know, and I think again, let's think about how we pay this forward. And, you know, our public lands and our public waters and the opportunities that go along with them are really unique in the world. And, you know, we should all be proud of that, you know, and we should think about what part we can play to not only keep it the way it is right now, but enhance those opportunities. And I think this is one way that, you know, many more people can help contribute.
We'll be back after a quick break.
You ever think about what might be in the water you're drinking every time you fill up your water bottles while you're in the outdoors? I try not to, and I really don't, because I use Sawyer water filters. Sawyer filter technology, because of their high standards, every filter is individually tested 3 times through the process. I've been using their permethrin product for years now to protect me from, well, quite frankly, ticks, and the picaridin to keep the flies at bay. Don't let bad water, insects, or a tick bite cut your trip short or even ruin it. Use Sawyer products. Go to your local outdoor retailer and ask for Sawyer products, whether it's a water filter, insect repellent. They're likely to have it. You can also go to Sawyer's website and read more about these incredible, high-quality products that they offer for those of us who enjoy the outdoors.
Now, the backcountry hunters and anglers, you're speaking, you're the CEO of that organization. Is this something that your organization's advocating for, is expanding this and turning it into an outdoor legacy fund, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, I think we want to have the conversation, you know, and knowing, you know, again, like, we use backpacks, we use binoculars, we use hiking boots, you know, some of us mountain bikes, some of us kayak, you know, now it's your turn. Like, we want to pay more into the system too. But it's definitely something that, you know, we want to have a conversation around, and are starting to have more and more conversations out in Washington, D.C. And I think this thing, you know, again, with COVID, the impacts people have seen, the joy, the solace they have found in the public lands and public waters, I think it's an opportune time to do it. So it's definitely something that, you know, that we're engaged in and having conversations about. And I hope people join us in doing the same.
Yeah, this is more about spreading the wealth, right? Or having a bigger well to draw from to build upon this, it sounds
Absolutely.
Like. And I like that, right? This isn't like, hey, we don't want to pay more money, or, you know, we feel like we're paying too much. No, I like that message a lot, that, hey, you know, this is just, let's all become a part of this. Let's make this bigger and better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, I think that, you know, again, like, I think the timing is right, and the way that these things get done is people start talking about it. And that's why, you know, I wanted to be on your podcast today, is let's start having the conversation. And, you know, the more people know, I think, about this, you know, hopefully the more excited they get about that. And then they communicate that to their elected officials. And ultimately, you know, we can pass legislation that has impacts for generations to come. Like, you know, we've talked a lot about today about, the 1930s. And, like, let's have people remember that, you know, the 2020s, you know, and I'm very serious about that. It's like, this is a opportunity, like a once in a lifetime opportunity to really pay it forward. And, you know, and whatever, you know, they're doing podcasts, whatever they're doing, you know, in 100 years, I'd love for them to be talking about the Outdoor Legacy Fund the same way we talk about Pittman Robertson Act.
Right. This is a generation that we righted the ship and did some really awesome things. Here in New York, we have the oldest stretch of the Appalachian Trail is here in New York State. And we have areas, I mean, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania is just dotted with areas where you find these Civilian Conservation Corps projects. And my grandfather was in the Civilian Conservation Corps. And every time I see that, it's just, I stop and think about it. I'm like, what a legacy that generation left for us.
Absolutely. Right?
There's things still standing that they did. And also, I don't want to fail to mention the legacy of the people who advocated for the Pittman Robertson Act.
Totally. Totally.
And this is where we can make a mark.
We can. And we, you know, I say we stand on the shoulders of giants, you know, and now it's just our time to do our part to make sure that we continue on that legacy and that the future generations, you know, have something to enjoy and enhance themselves.
You know, I've talked a lot on past broadcasts about, you know, the COVID and more people coming out. And, you know, I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing. I think that, you know, there's the power in numbers, right? So now that group of people that can be out there advocating for something like this is growing.
Oh,
and that's
absolutely
a good thing, right?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the increased numbers are great, but they come with impacts. You know, if we did nothing, that would be a bad thing. But I think that, you know, folks that are out there on the ground, they see impacts on themselves personally. I mean, you were talking about these structures. I mean, any trailhead you go to, I mean, sometimes the garbages are overflowing, you know, the toilets aren't as great as they should be. The trail is getting beat up. Like, people have seen impacts. Let's do something about it to address those impacts. And I think this is, you know, a great way to do that.
And so those people, the newbies, so to speak, that are getting out for the first time, and for everybody this goes to, and when you read about upcoming legislation, get on the phone, right? Well, nowadays, on your computer, and send a note to your representative.
Totally.
That's their job. They represent you. You elect them, whether you voted for them or not, their job's to represent you. Don't hesitate to send them a message and say, hey, I'm in support. I live in your district and I'm in support of this bill. Would you please join me in supporting it?
Absolutely. And I think this world, well, democracy is run by those that show up. And, you know, one of the great things that we have is the ability to contact our elected officials. Now, you know, we may not have the biggest influence and the biggest, you know, deepest pockets, but together we can move mountains. And, you know, I referenced that Great American Outdoors Act that passed a couple years ago. There were some political overtones to that on kind of, I think, in some energy. But the people made that happen. And I think we should never forget that ultimately, you know, when we want something and we demand it, democracy will reward us.
Yeah, I'm a former politician, but I'm not anymore. Okay. I saw the light. I left the darkness and I've seen the light. But I can say this. There are two things that motivate a politician. It's the money that funds their campaigns and the people that vote for them. If they start to see the groundwater swelling at that, hey, these people really want this. They have to start weighing out, is it the money going towards my campaign from the big donors, or is it the people that are going to go to the ballot box and make sure I get back here next year?
Totally. No, I totally agree. And and you have an insight there. Thank you for your service. Even though, as you describe it, you were in the dark, but I thank you for your service.
Thanks. And, you know, all kidding aside, I enjoyed it. And it really was a pleasure to be able to serve in that capacity. I did it at a young age and it certainly has helped me through my adult life and maybe has added to some of my being a bit cynical about things. But, you know, when I hear things like this, when I read the article, Land, about, you know, this idea with the Outdoor Legacy Fund, you can't help but restore some of the faith we have. And as you put it, you know, maybe it's the 2020s where people can look back and say, hey, they got it right.
Absolutely. It's it'd be amazing to be a part of. And again, I think, you know, just this is something that brings us all together and gives us a vested interest in the places that we love so much.
All right. So here's what I'm going to say to my friends who enjoy the outdoors, who don't hunt or fish. Here's my message. I don't like getting messagey, but here's one of those few times where I might. We all donate money to different causes. I have memberships at different outdoor clubs. I give that money because I know it's going to a good cause. If this Outdoor Legacy Fund actually becomes something that our elected representatives have an opportunity to vote on, would you please ask them to? And when you're paying a few extra bucks for your gear, look at it this way. It's like a donation. Okay, I'm donating it to help preserve what I enjoy, the outdoors. And don't look at it as a tax or a punishment.
Well said. Well said. We're paying it forward, right?
Yeah. All right, Land, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast and discussing this very important topic. Like I said, this is something that has the opportunity, the possibility to become somewhat controversial, but it shouldn't. You know, we all should be just like stepping up, doing our part. Recognizing what needs to be done. And it's been great having this opportunity. And if you're back up here in the Catskills again, let me know. I'll meet you over at the West. I'll show you a few other breweries too. We'll go to the West Hill Brewery, and then we got some others we can go check out in the Catskills.
That sounds good, Martin. I'd enjoy that. Thanks again for the opportunity to come on the show today. You know, if folks want to know more about Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, they can go find us at backcountryhunters.org. doesn't mean we don't care about the anglers. We just didn't have enough room on the URL. And then you can find us on Instagram and Facebook as well. Instagram is probably our biggest platform, and you'll have daily updates and kind of what we're up to there.
All right, Land, we'll make sure we put that information in the description for the podcast and on our website. Land, keep up the good work. You've been listening to me, to Papa Bear here, talking to Land Tawney. Please go to his website. Land, keep up the good work. Keep fighting this good fight for us. This is certainly a worthy cause.
Thank you, Martin. And thanks for the opportunity to talk with you today.
All right, everybody, get out there, have some fun, and be safe out there. Come on. Please. This episode of Papa Bear Hikes has been brought to you by Avalon Publicity. Avalon Publicity, increasing the digital footprint of content creators and skilled professionals via website development and social media services. For more information about Avalon Publicity, go to their website, avalonbusiness.org. That's avalonbusiness.org.